This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Attorney General and Exxon that knows anything, but the Attorney General says it suffered Exxon suffered a 22-foot-long gash that led to the rupture that gushed up to around, I guess, 300,000 gallons of tar sands, thicker. This is thicker type of crude moving through those older pipes. Joining us for an update is Eric Mole, is an activist campaigner with Tar Sands Blockade. He's been there with a film crew trying to hold the locals accountable. It's not easy because, as I said, this is sort of a no-go zone, no-fly zone. Nobody goes there except those that are okayed by Exxon. So we don't even really have an independent monitor, and journalists are having a hard time as well. So we're delighted to have you back, Eric Mole, Tar Sands Blockade campaigner. There was a storm last night. What did that do to the already troubling situation around the various environs?
Well, it was a pretty big storm. There were some tornadoes that touched down in other areas. Thankfully, none of them came through the spill zone, but a lot of water came down, and the hydrology is actually kind of interesting here. Lake Conway is a man-made lake formed by the damming of a creek here. And in order to keep all the homes around it from flooding, whenever it rains, they have to release a lot of that water through the dam. And we were out reporting as the storm was coming in, and it's pretty clear that it was spreading the contaminants further. We found evidence of oil in the Bell Slough Wilderness area, and just in a lot of waterways that do ultimately lead to the Arkansas River. But we haven't received back any test and any water tests yet to verify all that. But it's definitely a big concern, and we're getting reports, independent reports from many different residents that Exxon has been sending boats out in the middle of the night and recovering dozens or even hundreds of dead fish. Just they trawl with nets and just bring up nets and nets full of dead fish and get them out of there at night. Fish and other animals as well.
Now, yesterday was April 10th. That was a day when ExxonMobil was ordered via the Arkansas Attorney General to show why their pipeline leaked and ruptured. The Attorney General says that they have received, I guess, some 12,587 pages of documents, including more than 200 blueprint-sized diagrams. But, of course, it's only ExxonMobil and the Attorney General that really knows what's going on, right? This is they've turned this, Exxon essentially has turned this into a no-fly zone, no-walk zone, nobody-goes-anywhere zone unless you've got an Exxon pass. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. And we've been continuing to see a lot of police harassment as we're trying to investigate. We have been able to get into some of those areas, but you know, those documents you mentioned, as far as I know, they're not open to the public. It's just the Attorney General who has them. But I mean, really, we know why this thing spilled. It was because they were pumping this corrosive stuff through a 65-year-old pipe. It's the exact same reason that the Enbridge line spilled in Kalamazoo 3 years ago.
All right, now, and again, remind people, we're talking about a situation where older piping is expected to deliver. This is their, you know, they haven't even built the tar sands pipeline, the one coming down, the XL coming down from Canada. So they're pumping this stuff through these old pipelines, and that's a big problem, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, this stuff is corrosive, whether it's a new pipe or an old pipe. And I don't know, just one of the really, really unfortunate things that we've been seeing here, and that you kind of see anytime there's a spill like this that often isn't fully reported on, is the fact that not only the residents, but the workers are really, really suffering the most from this. We're seeing work crews that are getting right down in this stuff, you know, cleaning it up with rakes and shovels and those paper towel type things that they have, and none of them have masks. Some of them aren't even wearing gloves. And none of them have been informed that they're cleaning up tar sands and not crude oil. Everyone we talk to is under the impression that it's crude oil and that the air quality has been tested and that they're fine. But the air quality trucks only come through at certain times of day. They don't come through at night when residents say the smells are the worst. And beyond that, they're testing on the roads. They aren't actually testing inside the spill site with those air quality trucks. And, you know, the way a gaseous contaminant spreads, the difference in terms of concentration when you're actually a worker there cleaning it up and somebody standing on the road could be orders of magnitude in terms of the parts per million or billion or whatever.
And are they trying, is there any active attempt to keep you from actually interviewing the workers? Are they trying to keep the workers separate?
Yeah.
Please talk about
that. If any worker is anywhere near any of their bosses, we never get a chance to talk to them. And it seems like a lot of the construction crews, a lot of the people that have been hired, some of them were hired on Craigslist, you know, hired from the locals, and they're basically under the supervision of the Exxon spill response team, which is a group of people who basically do this as a job. They go from spill to spill, and they are kept relatively busy because Exxon does have quite a few spills every year. This one's getting a lot of attention, but you know, it's not an isolated incident.
And tell us a little bit about the situation now in terms of the community. Are they starting to get a little more information? Are we hearing anything about the impact, health impact, stuff like that?
Yes. Well, a lot of people are still feeling the health impacts. There was we posted a photo not long ago of workers in, that day they actually were wearing some protective gear, but not masks, working right in front of a subway that was open for business. We went and we talked to the workers in that subway and a lot of the other businesses in that plaza, and pretty much everyone we talked to, at least right after the spill, was feeling the effects of it.
Really? And they were willing to talk to you about some of the health effects? I imagine the kids are most impacted.
Yeah, the week after the spill, about 8 children were sent home from school sick. There was actually some local community members were hoping to have a meeting at the school about sort of getting together and organizing against Exxon. But Exxon actually gave a $15,000 gift to the school that there was a big controversy over whether or not the school should even accept it. But they did accept it, and now that meeting is no longer allowed to happen there. So there's some kind of sketchy things going on there.
And in terms of Exxon maintaining control, are you saying that they're working very closely with local law enforcement to keep reporters, to keep people seeking information out?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're directly in command of the local law enforcement.
And the EPA, where are they?
I've been told that there is at least one EPA official somewhere, but I've never seen them. And I mean, there is a Fish and Wildlife Service people, but they're also pretty clearly taking orders from the spill response team.
Are activists planning to stay down there, continue to watch this? Is this going to be part of the campaign against, the expanded campaign against tar sands? Is this an example of the things that people are concerned about?
Oh, definitely. And really, I think that, you know, in any of these man-made disasters, these man-made dirty energy disasters, whether it's a spill or something like Hurricane Sandy, or, you know, you might as well call it Hurricane Exxon or Hurricane Chevron, those things like that are really, really critical places for the movement to show that we can take care of our own a lot better than the government and the corporations can. And communities can take care of themselves and they can take care of each other. And in doing so, they can become more organized and better able to resist this kind of corporate violence in the future.
All right, Eric, we appreciate you being with us. How do people find out more information about the tar sands blockade? They might want to be a part of it, participate. They might want a lot more information. How can they get that?
Well, you can just go to the tarsandsblockade.org. Sorry, not the tarsandsblockade.org. It's tarsandsblockade.org. And if you happen to be in North or East Texas in the next couple of weeks, there's a benefit concert happening for a landowner who's been fighting against TransCanada's Keystone going through their property. So you can find all that info on the website.
Well, we're going to check back with you on that. We really appreciate you taking the time out and what the work, the important work that tar sands blockade is doing now there and in other places. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks a lot.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Coming up next, we're going to have a visit from Ziad Abbas. He's the one of the associate directors of the MECCA. That's the Middle East Children's Alliance. And he's going to talk to us a little bit about the ongoing torture, imprisonment of thousands of Palestinians, even when the president and the secretary of state the secretary of state is talking about progress. Can you believe it? He's talking about progress. He's making progress, even though the settlements are going apace and expanding. More on that coming up. Stay with us. And we're back. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This show is produced by Mike Biggs, and want to give him some shout out on the air. Thank you, Mike. Joining us in the studio is Ziad Abbas. As I said, he is he's the director, associate director, new visionary for Middle East Children's Alliance, along with Barbara Lubin. Ziad, welcome back to Flashpoints. We know there's an event coming up, but I always like to get a bit of an update from you on what's going on in occupied Palestine. The president was there. Kerry was there. President left. Kerry went back. Kerry announced he's hopeful. Are you hopeful?
Yeah, I'm hopeful not because Kerry or the president. I'm hopeful because I am. I count on my people and I count on the Palestinian people's struggle. Long time before Oslo Agreement, we can't count on the American foreign policy in the Middle East at all, and because it's biased policy. They are standing with Israel, and they are actually supporting the Israeli occupation and funding the Israeli occupation.
With advanced weaponry, of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
The latest advanced weaponry.
Absolutely.
Against slingshots.
Yeah, Palestine right now, it's like for them, the question with the United States, they don't count on the American government. People, they count on people, like we count on the American people to take a stand and to raise their voices and to change the American foreign policy in the Middle East, because the harm its effect, not just Palestinian, the whole people in the Middle East. And recently, as you know, the President Obama visited Palestine when you have like 16 Palestinian political prisoners in hunger strike. And they are, some of them, almost 8 months within this hunger strike, protesting their conditions, and they have very simple demands, and they were ignored totally by the American government, and they were ignored totally by the president's visit. And actually, he was in very close area to their jails, like just few miles from their jails. And
he could have met some kids in prison, some young people in jail.
Yeah, well, they are not far. This is the issue with Palestine, like with the Israelis, even the Israeli government and Israeli people, what we call them, the Israelis, and they are not living far from 19 prisons and jails. They have it in their land, and when they drive their children every morning to school, they pass the jails. They pass where the Palestinian people, Palestinian children, Palestinian youth, and Palestinian women, they are tortured and jailed and facing different kind of persecution styles by the Israeli government.
Well, there's also an expanding movement of very courageous folks who on various levels of hunger strikes and resistance to the occupation and to this continuing illegal imprisonment, settle building, everything that is supposed to be wrong under international law is ongoing, and you've got the United States and the Western world turning their back. So we have prisoners putting their lives on the line. Could you remind people exactly what's going on in the jails?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, we need to, when we speak about Palestinian political prisoners movement, we need to go back to the history. Even during the British mandate and in our history, there were thousands of Palestinian people. They were jailed during the British. Even some of them, they were hanged. And we have part of our culture, actually, a lot of songs and books and poetry around people they were hanged, especially in 1936, Muhammad Jamjoum, Mu'attaz Ziri, Fuad Hijazi, these people they were hanged. After 1948, since the establishment of Israeli government, Palestinians they were arrested and tortured, and they are faced different kind of torture styles. It was traditional torture styles or new styles invented by the Israeli occupation. Since 1967 until now, the statistics, like recently, it says like around 800,000 Palestinians, they experienced the jail. They were in jail, and you have tens of thousands of them, they are children. And we, as we work in Middle Eastern Alliance and our focus children, we see like the children right now, they are targeted by the Israeli occupation in different ways. Right now, in this moment, I'm speaking with you. I was like reading the statistics before I came to this program. 239 children right now, in this moment, they are in Israeli jails.
239 children,
they are below 18 years old. And you have children, they are in jail, their age only 14 years old. And they have special military orders and military laws targeting children, how to deal with children. And the racism in this kind of law, you know, Israel, they try to legitimize their policy by, they say, we have laws, we have military orders, etc. But in reality, for example, children, they are between 12 to 14 years old. They're supposed like to meet a judge, civil judge, in 48 hours. But if you are a Jewish a boy the same age, in 12 hours they should meet a judge and they should learn about their rights from the judge. This is like the way how they deal with Palestinian in a different way. And the Israelis, when you speak about political prisoners, as I said, 800,000, you will not find any Palestinian family. They didn't experience the jail. They didn't, like, their houses didn't attacked by the during the night, and the Israelis, they came, and there is someone from their families. And some families, actually, even the same family since the British mandate until now, generation by generation, they are just became inexperienced in jails. Right